This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
This is The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark. Every year, thousands of men, women and children become victims of human trafficking, whether in their own countries or abroad. They are threatened, abused, exploited, often find themselves in positions described as modern-day slavery or worse. Now, almost every country in the world is affected by this. And so in efforts to highlight the issue and emphasize the need to combat this heinous crime, the United Nations has declared the 30th of July every year today, in fact, as World Day Against Trafficking in Persons. So in conjunction with that, I'm speaking this morning with Gerald Joseph, Commissioner at Suhakam, and Labour Rights Consultant Liva Sridharan. Gerald, Liva, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Morning. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So first off, I want to get both of your perspectives on the piece of news that we had in June, which was that the US had decided to downgrade Malaysia to Tier 3 in its trafficking in persons report. Now, there are some who say that this was more of a technical issue, seeing as we were already on the watch list for 2 years prior to that, and the US hadn't seen any significant improvement. What do you both think of this? Gerald, perhaps we start with you, and then we go to Liva.
No matter how technical a report is, I would never want to see us on any list that is called a downgrade. It is saddening. It is a moment of being not a proud Malaysian, but more so for the victims who continue to suffer such easy exploitation. I think this is the key word to check whether our country offers a protection system for victims. Trafficking is a huge business, and many are trafficked into Malaysia. But what happens to them, I think, is where the report unpacks a lot more. For me, I think Tier 2 watch, Tier 1 watch, I think all of us have a joint responsibility to move ourselves up. And I think it's the government of the day that needs to prove intent, need to prove action, both proactive and policy and legislative changes, in order to show that we are actually doing well. We need to ask ourselves, we need to ask the ministers, the government, and all policymakers, hey, how are we doing in terms of stopping trafficking? Have we actually checked how this trafficking route still happens? And if it happens, are we able to differentiate clearly between victims and perpetrators? I think one of the highlights of the report is the unclarity that even victims seem to be stuck in that so-called investigative processes, and they suffer while investigation is going on, and some of them put in protection houses for a long period of time. And if that is the case, if victims feel this is not in their favor, then you'll have less and less people coming out to assist the police in finding the perpetrators.
Liva, what has been your experience of the situation as a labour rights consultant? Do you feel that the authorities perhaps have made little to no headway in addressing this issue?
So I think where I'm coming from and the way I look at the trafficking report is this. I think what the report does for me is that it magnifies the choices we have made as a nation in how we handle and tackle human trafficking. The trafficking report is a reflection on whether we have chosen to amplify the voices of victims or to silence them through oppressive security measures and the creation of unsafe spaces, you know, for victims to come out and voice complaints or concerns. You know, it is a reflection of the choices we have made regarding how we choose to treat people in our land and how we choose to respond to those who are marginalized. It is a choice we have made as a nation with our attitudes of xenophobia, of racism, and specifically as a government on how we have chosen to allocate our resources, whether we have chosen to invest our resources to provide care for victims, or whether we have chosen to use most of our resources in conducting raids and arresting migrant workers without first understanding their plight. So to me, this report is also a reflection of the choices that the Malaysian government has made, whether it chooses to arrest and investigate corrupt officials, or whether it chooses to turn a blind eye to corruption. And the choices that the government makes actually has an implication on all of us and not just on the victims of human trafficking.
So could you elaborate on that then? I mean, what are the implications that you see of this to Malaysia?
Okay, so you see, even if you look at the impact of COVID on trafficking specifically, right, the policy decisions that the government has chosen to undertake is to make everywhere feel not particularly safe for, you know, whether it's me, you or migrant workers. The way we have responded to the pandemic, you know, we have turned it into a security issue. We see an increase in the presence of police. We see an increase in the presence of RELA and military officials. You know, when I go out to pack my lunch and I drive home, I know I haven't done anything wrong. You know, I've kept within my district boundaries. I've kept within the 10-kilometer radius. But when I see a police roadblock, I feel uncomfortable, even though I have not done anything wrong. So imagine how much worse it is for a migrant worker, because what we have right now are policies which make things that much more unsafe for migrant workers. You know, we have large-scale policies that have asked Malaysians to report undocumented migrant workers when we see them. We've got policies that unfairly target migrant workers. And, you know, because of these discriminatory policies, it is harder for people to actually access the kind of help that they need.
And this is obviously very reflective of a wider problem of xenophobia in this country. I just want to, though, highlight how the identification process occurs between someone who is a migrant worker, illegal or otherwise, and someone who is a victim of human trafficking. How is it that authorities go about making that identification right now?
You know, Lynn, if I were to ask you, right, what does a trafficking victim look like to you? You know, or what is human trafficking? Would you be able to provide me with these answers? I mean, this is a really basic question, and every layer of society needs to be able to answer this question. Whether it's law enforcers, policymakers, the general public, we need to know what human trafficking looks like to us. And both you and Gerald pointed out that one of the key gaps that needs to be addressed is actually victim identification. Mm-hmm. So as a society and as a nation, if we do not have an answer to these questions of what it is that a victim of human trafficking looks like, or what is the definition of human trafficking, it will be that much harder for us to address it. So generally, I feel like there needs to be an improvement in our understanding, you know, of our different roles and perspectives on what trafficking is, you know. And I think without this victim identification, what we end up doing is we end up, making general decisions on what victims of human trafficking look like. And so this can be seen in very clear-cut examples when law enforcement officials conduct raids towards migrant workers. So what happens is law enforcement officials put on a security lens and they look at it in terms of documentation status. So if I've arrested you during a raid and, you know, I look at your documentation, you've got no passports or you've got a passport with an expired work permit, automatically what happens is I take you through the court processes and you're tried as a criminal and not as a victim. There's no thinking or analysis as to how this person has arrived in the situation. Was the person smuggled into Malaysia? Or if the person has come in with documents, with proper documents, why is it that the person now lives in Malaysia with an expired passport or an expired work permit? Like, what has happened throughout his or her migration process that has led to this situation? Was this in fact a victim of human trafficking, or was he a victim of human exploitation? Mm. So we don't sit and think about this. What we do is we cast this net and we say, oh look, these are the number of people who have violated Malaysian law and they ought to be punished.
I think how they become victimized then I think is the test. So if a person legitimately wants to come in as an economic migrant, more often than not, as the stories are coming out of the victims, is that along the way, the cheating happens, the exploitation happens, and then de facto, they become victims of what is now called contemporary forms of forced labor. You know, when they arrive on our shores, they should be given a chance to explain themselves to the authorities on what happened. You know, so I think guilty should be assigned to those in power of the supply chain who brings them in, who decides to employ them, or then terminates the employment, who underpays them, who doesn't give them a place to stay. So the TIP report, the Trafficking in Persons report, speaks about forced labor and the lack of Malaysia's response to forced labor situation. I think it's one of the reasons why we've not been able to bench up our or push up our marks. We have enough language, but we don't have enough political will to follow through on managing this situation. I think the notion that foreigners coming to work are always trying to exploit our system, I think gives the protection of them second tier power and energy as compared to the first tier, which is, oh, security. We have to show we are strict. We have to arrest, jail, deport, blah, blah, blah. And in that spirit of what they think is the right thing to do, many are victimized as not being able to afford any protection in the Malaysian system. Although the Atipson law is supposed to be a very strong law, but I think from our Suhakam experience, we did the our inquiry on the Wang Kalian trafficking situation. It was a dark chapter in Malaysia. 134 bodies were found. Sadly, no one knows their name. Until today, the question is that begs to be answered is, who are the big players that enable them to be able to come to our side? The government was pushed to set up a Royal Commission and inquiry, but yet today that report is not made public, despite the promises of early this year that it will be tabled, that it's completed. And yet it shows that isn't there any seriousness on the findings of a Royal Commission inquiry to stop any more trafficking and any more dead bodies appearing in different parts of Malaysia.
I'm speaking with Gerald Joseph, Commissioner at Suhakam and Labour Rights Consultant Leva Sridharan. Up next, the question of whether or not we need more laws or perhaps just better enforcement. Stay tuned to BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
On the Breakfast Grill this morning is Labour Rights Consultant Leva Sridharan and Gerald Joseph, Suhakam Commissioner. In conjunction with today, the 30th of July, which has been designated by the United Nations as World Day Against Trafficking in Persons. So, Gerald, when it comes to addressing these investigations that are instituted, whether it be the RCI or whether it's investigations into the state of worker housing of certain manufacturing companies, oftentimes we don't necessarily hear the conclusion of these cases. Is there enough follow-through? Is there enough transparency in the conduct of these investigations, do you find?
Suhakam also gets some of this information, and because of our powers to investigate, we try our best to follow through. But you're right, the powers to investigate lies in our police, immigration authorities. They do have it. The task force set up under the Anti-Trafficking Council, I think, is quite fast to respond whenever information is passed to them. But you're right, only recently, 2 weeks ago, the PDRM released statistics on how many cases have been saved, how many victims have been saved. But the problem is the slow nature of prosecution of the perpetrators. And I can understand, because it's an international network, so it will then demand a whole series of international or Interpol or interagency work. So it could be delayed. But the question is, why should the victim suffer even more to wait for the finalization of the cases? So this poor victim already victimized round one, then round two, waiting in the protection homes for the case to be finalized. This person not allowed to work, not allowed to move around freely, or even to, if she or he travels back home, then you may lose the whole case. So it does not really augur well for finding perpetrator in the sharpest way. So I think there is a whole push to amend the law. And I think when we failed in terms of specific investigation, then a more policy reach would need to be taken. And that's why I think Leva mentioned about immigration raids. I think Home Ministry will need to have some answers on why they keep using a securitized thinking that all these people are bad people out to make Malaysia dangerous. or the human resource ministry, why are they allowing overcrowding labor place? But I think one of the hints I got is that the number of enforcement officers at the federal level of the human resource, I think, is only 400 plus. Then we can do the math, and we know the thousands of factories, and I'm not even sure how they're going to check to stop this.
So, Leva, I have two questions that I'd like to pose to you, based in part of what Gerald said as well. Do you also think that this is a political will issue, that we have the laws in place, but they just aren't implemented effectively enough? And I also do wonder if you could provide us perhaps a little bit of insight into the protections in place for victims of trafficking while they are waiting for their cases to be heard in court.
Right. I do agree that there's a lack of political will. And I say this because I want to touch on the point of the lack of transparency and specifically on the lack of transparency in sharing of data. Now, this is not a big ask. This is something that the government can easily share with us. If you've got a if you conducted a rescue and you've rescued victims of human trafficking, you have got that data on how many victims you have rescued. If you've gone and conducted a raid in a company and you realize that the company has violated certain acts and have violated rights of migrant workers, you have got that data. So I think the problem is, and often as civil society, when we ask the government to provide us with this data, we are met with this excuse where they say it's Official Secrets Act. So we're not able to share this information with you. And this is the problem. If information is not shared openly with the public, what happens is there's a lack of a check and a balance system, and there's lack of accountability. So this is something that can really easily be rectified. So yes, I would say that there definitely is a lack of political will. And pertaining to your second question on protection mechanisms for trafficking victims in government shelters, some victims stay up to 6 months or even longer in these trafficking shelters. And I've been told that victims are only able to use the phone once a month, and they're given about 5 minutes to make a phone call to a loved one or a family member. There's no regular medical checks. There's lack of psychosocial support for victims. So we know that victims of human trafficking will need all this additional mental health services, which is also lacking in government shelters. So the question then goes back to what I was saying earlier about choice. Do we choose to use our resources and invest our resources in care mechanisms or in protection mechanisms, or do we choose to use majority of our resources in law enforcement and securitization of things? So it's a question that we need to think about, and it's definitely a question of political will.
So the last question that I want to pose to the both of you in this interview is to do with how you would like to see things done differently. And this is obviously something that we've touched on throughout this interview. But if you had the power to rewrite our anti-trafficking initiatives, I mean, how would you restructure them? What would perhaps be some of the low-hanging fruit you'd go for, some of the more longer-term measures that you would like to see implemented?
Move forward with real action. I think a few days ago, I got an email seeking public input, and I'm telling this to all of you. There's a feedback on the National Action Plan on Forced Labor, NAPFL, that is being drafted for 2021-2025. So please, everyone, go to the website, put your input. So something like that would frame what the government should do. More specifically, move away from xenophobic tendencies. And okay, maybe the public will do that, but I want government leaders to stand up and say, please, we cannot enable such xenophobic behavior, because that behavior then translates back into society, family, and into officials. And this links to maybe 3 years ago, there was an independent committee on migrant workers policy that was set up under the previous government. I was a member of that committee, and like most committees, completed our report, submitted to the government, and still waiting for it to be made public and to be utilized, because we were thinking that the whole management system of foreign workers in Malaysia had so many exploitative gaps. It was so easy that it was a good business. At the background of this is our Malaysian sad culture of corrupt practices and corruption. So many loopholes in our security concerns. And this came out during COVID-19 when the Ops Benteng was done so well, suddenly we realized, hey, there were so many lubang in the country, and how come that was happening? Only during COVID, we realized that we needed the ops banking. That should be part of our national security all the time. But to stop that is to stop corruption.
So when you say loopholes, what do you mean particularly? Do you mean border gap loopholes? Do you mean loopholes in the law?
Yeah. So I think in that is the physical holes where people can come in illegally, and it's dangerous for Malaysian. So why is it our security forces on the ground were not able to detect from Wang Kalian to even today? They always say this Jalan Tikus, this small unofficial routes. There were a few arrests of immigration officers, I think, the last 1 year. Kudos to MACC. We need to get more of them, more of the senior officials involved. But how come it's only coming out now, that, and we know this has been happening for so long. The other loophole is the gap in implementation. I believe Suhakam realizes that the Immigration Act confers a huge power to the Immigration Department and the Director General. But I think if there's no respect for refugees and asylum seekers, then the nature for exploiting of these people will be so easy. And I think that's why we are still far off from that mark that we hope one day to achieve.
And Leva, I mean, what are some of the low-hanging fruit and the longer-term measures you would target here?
So it's just one thing. I think for me, it's the improvement of victim identification. And this can be done very, very, very simply, in a very simple way. I'll give you an example. So the United Kingdom has something called a first responder organization. So this is a cluster of organizations, including law enforcement as well as NGOs. So what happens is anybody in this first responder organization can refer a suspected case of modern slavery to a national referral mechanism using just a one standardized form, right? The claims will be investigated by a multidisciplinary team. So this, I think, is the key word here, multidisciplinary approach in terms of victim identification. So in the UK, so individuals who are recognized as potential victims of modern slavery, they go through this process. And then there's specialized services tailored for these victims for 45 days. And this includes legal services, accommodation, protection, and independent emotional and practical support. And so after this 45 days, in the event where the individual is not actually identified as a victim, then they are referred to authorities such as the immigration and police for further investigations or for, if there's any disclosure of wrongdoing. So it's something that we can implement here very, very effectively. Just enhance collaboration between government officials and civil society organizations. Come up with a means in which we can investigate victims of trafficking. Even if you conduct raids, get NGOs involved, get NGOs involved, give NGOs time with the victims or, whoever you've arrested during the raids. Let NGOs as well as enforcement agencies actually go through the experiences of these victims, and then you decide what to do with the victims after.
Thank you very much to the both of you for joining me this morning. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
This morning, I've been speaking with Gerald Joseph, Suhakam Commissioner, and Labour Rights Consultant Leva Sridharan in conjunction with the 2021 World Day Against Trafficking in Persons. This has been The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.